Don't be so hard on yourself. You're here, aren't you? What? Sipping cocktails? If you want to get dangerous, I can make that happen. Amelia held Laura's gaze. Of that, I have no doubt. Nearby, a woman spilled her champagne, breaking the moment. The man she was with tossed a handkerchief over the spill before leading the woman away. Now tell me, what exactly is your angle? Said Amelia. It sounds like something bigger than some daily story for the blotto. Very funny. Our pseudo-newspaper is called The Blot. And yes, I have to admit that I think this movement, what's going on down here, might be better as a long feature article. The New Woman. There's so much to encompass. Be careful about writing about the club, though. Remember, what's said there is strictly off the record. Of course. The fact that Amelia had accomplished all she had by breaking rules, by pushing boundaries, made Laura a little less concerned about writing about the club, especially as it wasn't for publication. Laura didn't mention that she'd met some members for coffee, to ask them questions about the views and passions expressed during the meetings. Since she couldn't openly take notes, it helped her round out the competing viewpoints. One of which was being loudly discussed by a group standing next to the bartender, where Amelia and Laura waited for their drinks to be stirred. Don't let men fool you. The speaker, ironically, was a tall man, verging on gangly, with thick curly hair that spilled over his forehead and a jaw that jutted just beyond the point of handsome. As he spoke, he waved his arms, threatening the drinks of those gathered around him. They love the idea of the new woman, one who will raise their children, clean their house, and then make themselves available to all. A couple of women around him gasped. Amelia stepped forward. Then these men, as you call them, notwithstanding that you're one yourself, have the idea of a new woman wrong. The new women will make themselves available to whomever they choose, not necessarily to all. And what's more, they will not only demand sexual power, they will also seize economic power. The man squared his shoulders. Is that so? Yes. And men are threatened by this. You see, while there is more than enough sexual power to go around, economic power is fixed. If we take more, you get less. Your logic holds true. It's a pleasure to meet an equal adversary. He held out his hand. I'm Frank Tannenbaum. Don't believe a word I say. I'm only acting as devil's advocate. We must be prepared to counterattack. Dr. Amelia Potter. Amelia had a glint in her eye. Dr. Potter, of course. Delighted. Mr. Tannenbaum lifted his glass. Let me put on my devil's horns again. Women, the uptowners will say, are the guardians of what's morally right. They keep the rest of us on the straight and narrow. If women throw off those shackles, won't civilization be doomed? Having a husband and child does not make one morally right. There are more ways of living than a man, a wife, and a brood, said Amelia. It's time to expand our view of the household and throw off the shackles of gender oppression. I can work, I can have a child, and I can love whomever I like, just as you can. Laura, along with some of the others, nodded encouragingly. That was what she wanted also. Well, not the love whomever part, but the work and raise a child part, certainly. We are restless, energized, and will not back down, said Amelia, building momentum. Whether for the right to vote, or access to birth control, or the right to make love outside of the bonds of marriage. Mr. Tannenbaum threw back his head and laughed. I adore this woman. The discussion broke up as more guests arrived. Who is that? Asked Laura. Frank Tannenbaum emigrated from Austria when he was young, went to Colombia. This winter, he's been organizing protests for the poor. Laura had read about the nightly protests in the newspaper, 500 or 600 men marching through the streets before approaching a church to demand food and beds. What exactly are they trying to prove? When they're turned away? That the clergy don't really care about the unemployed, that they are heartless. He seems awfully young to be leading protests. He's 21. Interesting that Amelia knew his exact age. You seem impressed. He's a natural leader. And smart, you've seen that. While we've been tucked away in our beds during this particularly harsh winter, he's out marching, calling attention to injustice. Why don't I see you marching out there with him? Laura teased. I'll march tonight if you will. Amelia's eyes shimmered. We can go together. They're meeting at Rutgers Square and heading to St. Alphonsus Church on West Broadway. You can write about it for the Blotto. It would make a good item for tomorrow's reporting and writing class, Laura had to admit. None of the other students would be out on a cold winter's evening if they could help it. That would certainly prove to Professor Wakeman that she was as good as the men. Furthermore, she wasn't quite ready to quit Amelia's company. She threw back her drink, wishing she'd worn long underwear beneath her skirts. Let's do it. What looked to be over 500 men had gathered in the wedge-shaped area off of East Broadway on the Lower East Side by the time Amelia and Laura arrived at the protest. The winds whipped their skirts as Amelia guided Laura across the street, where they took shelter in a doorway. Are you sure this is safe? Asked Laura. She'd never been out after dark like this without Jack. Two women walking together attracted more attention than she would have liked. Walk tall, don't make eye contact. Here he comes. Amelia pointed to Frank, who strode through the crowd and pulled himself up onto the base of a street lamp, hanging onto it with one hand for support. The light shone on him like a spotlight, glinting off his dark hair. Why he wasn't wearing a hat on a night like this was beyond Laura. He began shouting for everyone's attention, and soon all heads swiveled up at him. A hush came over the crowd. I know that many of you are out of work, he said. Over 300,000 men are out of work, so you are not alone. The men cheered. This makes 10 consecutive days that we've come out and raised a commotion. You deserve better. You want to work, to feed your family, and the city, the country, has failed you. This is the era of progressive policies, where the greed of capitalism will be replaced with a safety net for all. You, me, all of us demand more from our taxes, more from our politicians, more from our government. The crowd was whipped up into a frenzy that matched the violent gusts of wind, some men leaping into the air. Laura looked around for other reporters covering the story but saw nothing. No men with notebooks, nor photographers lugging their cameras. It was day 10 of the protests after all, and frigid. They probably figured there was nothing new to report. She could already hear in her head the professor's disappointment at her lack of imagination, covering a story that had come and gone in the press. Frank asked for the men to quiet down, and they obeyed. Tonight, we'll approach the Catholic Church and ask for help. For beds, for food. If they refuse, we will expose their hypocrisy as we have the other churches who refused us. For putting their own riches before the riches of their flock. This nation's working class deserves more. In a graceful leap, Frank jumped to the ground and led the men to a church a few blocks away, reaching it just as the priest slammed the door to the church shut, locking it against them. A couple of men tried the side door, but no luck there either. By then, Laura and Amelia had become swallowed up by the crowd and were being pulled toward the front steps of the church, where men pounded on the doors, cursing and screaming. The police! The two words sliced through the air. The mob heaved into itself as panic began to spread. Sirens blared as a group of policemen came from behind, slamming their truncheons down hard on whoever stood in their way. Just to Laura's left, the sickening sound of wood on bone, followed by a howl of pain, made her clutch Amelia closer. There was no way out, not against the bulk of so many. "I'm so sorry. We have to get out of here. I'm so sorry." Amelia wrapped her arm around Laura, and together they blindly shoved their way north, or maybe west. Laura had lost all sense of direction. Laura lost grip of Amelia's hand twice, and twice she flailed about like a drowning swimmer before reconnecting with her friend. Finally, they reached an alley where they could catch their breath in the safety of darkness. On any other night, Laura wouldn't have been caught dead in an alley in this part of town, where rats and drunks scrambled and thieves lurked, hoping for an easy mark. But tonight, she didn't care that she couldn't tell what muck she was stepping on, nor the source of the foul smell that emanated from the ground. The dark alley provided safety for now. "We can stay here until it quiets down," said Amelia. "Then we'll get a taxicab and get out of here." Amelia held both of Laura's arms just above the elbow and stared hard at her. In the darkness, Laura could tell that her mouth was partly open, her gaze fierce. "Are you all right?"
"I'm fine."
"Thank God." As the mob began breaking up, the two women ran north until they came upon a taxicab. Inside, they sat close together. Laura felt Amelia shaking beneath her skirts, just as she was. She moved closer, drawing a renewed sense of strength and safety from being nestled together in the back seat.
"Well, that was exciting,"
Laura said quietly. Amelia let out an unladylike snort. "Your capacity for understatement never ceases to amaze."
"I suppose I'm the one who got us into this mess by daring you. From now on, we will stick to cocktail party chatter."
"I'm glad you dared me. I feel alive, don't you?" Laura did. Her lips were raw from the wind and the cold, and her skin tingled with electricity. When they reached Patchin Place, Amelia gave Laura a long hug. Laura clutched her friend close, unwilling to let her go. Finally, they parted, and Laura headed uptown, where the library loomed like a tomb in the darkness. Even though it was late, she sat down at Jack's desk, eager to get started before the events of the evening faded away. Being a reporter was much like being a bloodhound. Just as the dogs picked up a scent and tracked it from one spot to the next, reporters gathered up clues, moving from source to source, following the narrative to completion. She worried that if she waited until morning, the trail of inspiration might go cold. She wrote of what had happened, moment by moment, but also of how the clash spoke to the hopes of the future and the failures of the past. She wanted to get down the whole picture, just as she wanted to provide a well-rounded thesis on the women of the Heterodoxy Club, and how their words and actions would affect their daughters and the daughters who came after that. She'd picked up the scent of change, of revolution, and wanted to see where it took them all. The next day in class, she staggered to Professor Wakeman's desk, bleary with exhaustion, and watched as he read it through.
"My, my, Mrs. Lyons. A protest, with police even. When did all this happen?"
"Last night."
"You didn't make any of this up, did you?"
She wished he'd stop asking her that. "No, of course not."
"Quite the intrepid reporter, aren't you? What did your husband make of this?"
Jack had been sullen that morning, but that was nothing new. "My husband is fine with my studies, Professor."
"Quite the modern man, then."
Professor Wakeman gave her top marks. She knew she deserved no less. She also knew exactly who she wanted to share the good news with. Downtown, she turned onto Patchin Place and stopped cold.
Amelia's door was wide open. She stood on the stone step, her head tipped forward in a kiss, Jesse's arms wrapped around her waist. The two women remained locked together, unconcerned by the bold display of affection. Laura hung back, out of view. Here she was, bringing high-minded uptown morals downtown again. It was fine for two women to love each other, so why did she feel sick? No, not sick. Angry. She had felt so connected with Amelia last night during their terrible adventure, racing through the rabble, maneuvering this way and that without signals or words, as if they were a pair of birds in the sky. Seeing her share a close moment with someone else this morning felt like a betrayal. It was their story, not Amelia and Jesse's. But that wasn't it either. She was jealous. Because she wanted to be the one kissing Amelia's lips. Jack was her husband, and made her so happy, or had made her happy. She loved being in his arms, his very maleness. But with Amelia, she could talk of her fears and worries without censoring herself, or worrying that she'd take it personally and grow cold. They'd laughed more in these past couple of months than she and Jack had this past year. Part of that was the stress of his work and his book, of course, and her going back to school. There simply wasn't enough time. In fact, it wasn't fair to compare the two desires. Family life was far more complicated than this idea of free love could possibly encompass. She and Jack had children together, a household, a shared life. Yet sometimes, when she and Amelia walked down the street and Amelia linked arms with her, Laura's arm accidentally brushed Amelia's breast, and neither woman would pull away, not immediately. Even after, the ghost of the sensation lingered. Maybe her jealousy was simply a reaction to being thrust into a new, dangerous, and exciting world. How could life in a library even come close? She peered back around the corner as Jesse and Amelia kissed again, long and deep. She thought of Pearl and Harry. What would happen to them if she ever acted on her own desires? Women like her weren't tolerated north of 14th Street. This could not be. Amelia was her friend. That was all.
Chapter 13. New York City, 1993. I have to go with him in order to identify the stolen goods. Sadie sat next to Mr. Adriano in Dr. Hooper's office, where the antique grandfather clock had just rung 9:30. To Sadie, the logic couldn't be clearer. Time was of the essence. They had to case the downtown bookstores as soon as possible, at the very least to rule them out.
And that's why you're all dressed up? Like normal, I mean, Dr. Hooper asked.
She fingered the pearls at her neck, momentarily embarrassed. I have to come across as a wealthy book buyer, I figured.
I see.
He didn't seem convinced. He turned to Mr. Adriano.
You're all right with this? It makes sense. I couldn't pull it off alone. And I'll be there every step of the way.
Sadie caught a glance between them, a knowing look. This was a setup possibly to catch her in the act. No doubt Mr. Adriano would be watching her closely, but that was fine. She had nothing to hide. Other than her family's past. Valentina's comment in the park about the tambourine had been whirling around in Sadie's head since yesterday.
I suppose it's worth a shot, Dr. Hooper finally said.
The downtown train reeked of sweat and greasy metal. The passengers packed together with a physical intimacy that would have been overbearing if they didn't all refuse to look each other in the eye. An unspoken agreement that made city living possible. A pole separated Sadie from Mr. Adriano, their hands grasping it a few inches apart. This close, she realized he was taller than her by several inches, taller than she first thought. She didn't look at him, instead focusing on the small ketchup stain on one sleeve of his raincoat. "What's the plan for today?" she asked. "How do you want to play it?"
He raised an eyebrow. "Quite the lingo. We go in. You say you're looking for rare books for your collection, that you're willing to pay for items that are truly valuable. I'll hang back, pretending to be a random browser, and listen in." He paused. "We'll see what they offer up."
He stifled a yawn. "Out gallivanting last night?"
"Gallivanting."
He seemed to be considering the idea, the word. Maybe he didn't understand what it meant. "Out with the boys."
"I know what gallivanting means. No, I was up all night with a sick kid."
She glanced at his left hand. No ring, and he followed her gaze.
"Divorced. My kids live in Westchester. I went up last night to cover the night shift so my ex could get some sleep."
Something about being 3 inches away from each other with only one more stop to go made Sadie bold. "How long were you married?"
15 years. Long enough.
His answer was so matter-of-fact. "What happened?"
"The usual. What about you?"
"Divorced as well. A while ago." The train screeched to a halt. "This is our stop." Together, they made their way to two of the three downtown bookstores from Mr. Babenko's list. Both times Sadie stumbled through her inquiry, nerves getting the best of her. If the bookstore owners had the stolen items hidden away, they didn't show their hand. The volumes they did offer lacked the distinction of the Hawthorne and the Wolf Diary. Sadie hoped she wasn't blowing it. The last stop before they headed north to case the Uptown shops was called J&M Books, one of the remaining stores on the former Book Row on 4th Avenue. The place was empty of customers, and Sadie strode to the clerk's desk at the back of the shop. This time she'd try a different tack. "Hello, is the owner available?" She affected an English accent this time, which was met by a muffled guffaw from Mr. Adriano, who stood somewhere behind her doing his browsing thing. The clerk, a tall, thin man wearing a bolo tie, sat behind the counter.
"I'm the owner. Name's Chuck."
He held out his hand, which was manicured and smooth.
"How can I help you?"
She shook it. "I'm looking for something valuable, something rare as a gift to my husband. It's his birthday in a month, and I promised him something whopping."
"Whopping?"
"I want to give him a gift that will knock his socks off." She lifted her heels slightly at the end of the sentence. She needed to appear foolish enough to not understand the trade and wealthy enough to afford the best.
"It's his 50th, so the sky's the limit. Although I probably shouldn't tell you that."
The man loosened the tie around his neck.
"I see."
"For his 40th, I purchased an antique globe by Blau from the early 1600s. She made a point of looking down at the counter, where a couple of letters from famous authors were kept under glass, so as to give Chuck time to size her up. "Paid 40 grand, but was worth every penny to see the look of surprise on Cyril's face." She pointed to one of the letters. "Is this really from Dorothy Parker?"
"Sure is. Would you like to see it?"
"No, that's not what I want." She looked up, fixing him with a steady gaze. "I want something fabulous that no one else has. Do you have anything like that?"
"Right. I think there's something here, just in."
He disappeared behind a door marked employees only. Sadie looked around at Mr. Adriano, who raised his eyebrows before turning away as the man returned, clutching an oversized, ragged atlas.
"There's this."
He laid it down on the counter.
"An antique atlas from the 17th century. Quite an addition to any collection."
Sadie lifted the cover and examined it. She could tell already that the binding had been replaced. Some of the maps had suspicious markings, where an identifying mark had been either removed or painted over. How horrible, to mutilate what had been intact. Then again, it said something about the shop that they would try to fob this off on an unsuspecting buyer. "It's great, but I want something with words this time, not pictures."
"Huh. Hold on."
He disappeared again, coming back a few minutes later with a small stack of books.
"These were just about to go in the safe. Take a look, and if you see something you like, I can check with the seller.
Check with the seller?
These are quite rare. Just arrived from London.
Sadie sorted through the books. The top two were first editions, but not by noted authors. Then she got to the third and froze. The Scarlet Letter.
Willing herself to remain calm, she lifted the cover and flipped through it, pausing slightly on page 97.
There it was, the mark for the New York Public Library.
Whoever had taken it either hadn't known about the mark or hadn't yet had a chance to remove it.
This was the first edition, the one stolen from the Berg collection. In her hands.
Never read this one, she said. It's pretty, with the cover. She put it to one side and went through the other two. She immediately recognized the familiar stationer's ringback notebook. She opened it up carefully, and her heart leaped at the sight of Wolf's scrawled cursive, the lines rising up to the right, the date written in the margin.
How much for these three?
She included one of the lesser books to throw off the scent. The man scratched his cheek.
I'll have to ask the seller. What did you say your name was again? Elaine, is that you?
For some inexplicable reason, Mr. Adriano chose now to come forward, arms wide, pulling Sadie into a hug.
Sure is.
She went along with the charade, giving him a hard look at the same time. Why was he getting in the way?
It's been too long. Of course I'd run into you today. I have something fabulous to show you. Come here for a moment.
Will you excuse me, please?
Sadie gave an apologetic smile to the clerk and let Mr. Adriano drag her to the front of the shop out of sight of the desk.
What are you doing? She whispered.
Say you'll come back tomorrow to make the sale.
It would be like leaving her children behind, if she had children. They were in her hand. It was just a matter of taking them. And wouldn't Dr. Hooper be pleased? She'd be sure to get the permanent curator job at that point, no question. She'd be a hero, all problems solved.
I can't leave the books behind.
Mr. Adriano practically snapped at her.
You have to. The bookstore owner will want cash since they're hot. Do you have enough on you?
She hadn't thought of that.
Then what do we do?
Say you'll come back tomorrow. We'll bring some cops and make an arrest.
We have to wait a whole day?
Yes. Now go and let the man know.
Still, it had been worth it. At the very least, they knew where the books were. She walked back, chin lifted.
Chuck, I'll be back tomorrow. Can you let the seller know that I'm interested in these three books?
She pointed to them, her finger lingering on the Wolf diary.
My name is Elaine Edmondson, and I simply must have them.
I will, but I must ask you a favor.
She waited, worried.
My regular customers would be very upset to learn that I didn't let them in on my latest acquisitions, which means you'll need to be discreet about where you found them.
Oh, I can be discreet, Chuck. Don't you worry about a thing.
She watched, itching with irritation as he gathered up the stack in his hands.
So close. She was so close.
How long do we have to wait? Although the day was cool, Sadie was sweating in one of Luann's cashmere sweaters, her chosen outfit for the sting operation. She and Mr. Adriano had met in a coffee shop across from the bookstore, and together they watched from the window looking out for the unmarked car that meant that backup had arrived, and they could go meet Chuck and rescue the books from captivity.
However long it takes, said Mr. Adriano. It's not as if recovering stolen books is on the top of their to-do list.
It should be.
Sadie took a sip of coffee. The bitter taste made her stomach churn. Or maybe that was just her nerves. Once we do recover the books, what next? They'd already alerted Dr. Hooper to the success of the operation, and she could tell he was as excited as she was at the possibility of recovery.
We'll find out from this Chuck guy who the seller is and follow the trail from there.
Do you think it's an employee of the library?
She was trying to be vague, but Mr. Adriano picked up on her inference.
You mean Claude Racine?
I suppose so. He was the only other person with access, until they revoked it, of course. In fact, Sadie had deliberately kept the news of the sting from Claude, per the director's instructions, which made him even more of a suspect in Sadie's opinion.
How well do you know this Claude guy?
Too well.
The coffee had started working its way into her bloodstream and she felt a bolt of energy.
As I mentioned, we dated briefly earlier this year.
Huh.
Mr. Adriano raised one eyebrow like he didn't believe her.
The nerve. It was a brief affair. I called it off. It's too difficult when you're working together.
She still remembered their kiss at that Christmas party. They'd stood in a small hallway off of the room where the festivities were raging inside. That evening, Claude had put his hand on the back of her neck and drawn her to him, and she'd closed her eyes and enjoyed the sensation of his mouth on hers. It was a little too wet for her liking, but that was fine. It felt so good to be wanted again after so many years.
He'd laughed then, and she'd pulled back, ready to be offended, but he'd pulled her close again, this time sending his hand roving up to her breast.
Lovely, he'd said.
A group from the genealogy division had spilled out of the room and they'd pulled apart. Even though she and Claude hadn't spoken of the kiss after he returned from his vacation, she was certain that every comment between them, under Marlene's watchful eye, had been fraught. But then she'd spotted him in the hallway with the young page and soon after come upon the surviving spinsterhood book, which reminded her that her life was just fine as it was. But she didn't want to think about all that.
Mr. Adriano, what made you decide to start your own firm after retiring?
You can call me Nick. I figured my working days were over, but then my wife invested her part of the divorce proceedings with a scam artist and lost it all.
So you're helping her out?
Sure. She's the mother of my kids. Besides, I enjoy it. Otherwise, what would I be doing? I hate sitting around.
He spoke without any hint of resentment.
Although at the library, there's a little more action going on than I expected. A hotbed of intrigue, that place.
Well, it's not usually like that, I assure you. Hopefully by tomorrow, we'll be back to normal, which will be a big relief to me.
Nick's radio squawked. He looked outside and rose.
Let's go.
Inside the shop, Sadie headed straight to the back, where Chuck was waiting, wearing a different bolo tie and a crisp white shirt. She held out her hand.
Hello. I'm back to buy the books I set aside yesterday.
Right, Mrs. Edmondson.
Please call me Elaine.
Chuck eyed her up and down again, and she was glad she'd put some time into her hair and makeup. For a moment, she was also glad that Nick had seen her at her best.
The front door squeaked. That would be Nick, who'd said he'd hover within earshot and out of sight. She didn't want to let him down.
Chuck disappeared for a moment and came out carrying all three books. She took her time perusing each one, studying the inscription page and quality of the binding on the hawthorn, then checked that the last diary entry was intact on the wolf.
Lovely,
she murmured.
100,000,
Chuck said in a low voice.
Should she bargain with him?
No, better to get it over with.
Done.
You can wire the money into an account. Once I get it, you can retrieve the books. No receipts.
Of course, just send me the details. By the way, where did you find them?
She heard Nick cough, probably a sign to her to not try to drive the investigation on her own. But she had to know.
A client came upon them in his grandmother's attic in London.
She almost laughed.
Grandmother's attic? Pathetic that he couldn't come up with something more original.
The bell to the shop clanged hard as the cops burst in, wearing plain clothes, badges dangling from around their necks.
Stop what you're doing and stand back!
Sadie flattened herself against the wall as the cops went straight for Chuck, who stood frozen in place, hands up in the air. Then Nick was by Sadie's side, and together he and Sadie watched as Chuck was placed in handcuffs and read his Miranda rights before being let off, protesting the entire way. As the police carefully placed the books into evidence bags, it was all she could do not to hug Nick. The books were safe again. Hers again. Finally.
Chapter 14. New York City, 1993. A few weeks after Sadie's successful sting downtown, she was still giddy. Dr. Hooper had personally brought the books to the Berg collection and handed them over, thanking her and Nick for their detective work. Nick had kept his eyes on the books through the whole speech, as if he was scared they'd escape from their clutches again if he glanced away. After Dr. Hooper left, Nick had watched as Sadie secured them in the small safe that was lodged in the wall of her office. It was too small to hold much, but until the exhibit was up, she didn't want to risk their being out of her purview. Then she'd turned and given Nick a hug. She hadn't meant to. It was just he was standing right behind her and she was so happy, and his bulk seemed so huggable. He'd patted her back a couple of times and then disengaged, and she looked up, expecting to see horror in his eyes. But it wasn't that. He seemed sort of stunned, blinking hard, like he'd been hit upside the head instead of given a friendly squeeze. Since then, he'd stopped in to check on the Berg every couple of days and give her an update on the investigation. When she heard his confident knock on the door, a very different sound from the discreet rap of the regular scholars, she had to stop herself from rushing to open it. It was nice to have a friend. After her divorce, most of Sadie and Philip's friends had stayed close with Philip, who was much more a social animal than Sadie. He was the life of the party. She had to admit she'd turned maudlin after being dumped. Not much fun to be around and unapologetic about that fact, before Valentina's birth had provided a welcome distraction. Until now, though, she hadn't realized how isolated from her few friends she'd become. Maybe it was just because she and Nick had a common enemy in the book thief, or a mutual distrust of Claude, but she liked the camaraderie. If Claude was the thief, he showed no sign of concern at the turn of events. Whenever a knock on the Berg collection door revealed Nick, Claude muttered under his breath something about Inspector Clouseau having arrived. Claude's impertinence galled her, not the least because he wasn't out of the clear. The thefts had stopped after his key was revoked, which to her meant all signs pointed to him as the culprit. Today, Nick came by while Claude was out at a dentist appointment, and she took the opportunity to ask him about it point blank. What if he is the thief and we never find out the truth? She spoke quietly, as two patrons were in the room and she needed to stay put and keep watch over them.
We may not. Not if our boy Chuck keeps his mouth shut. He's hired an expensive attorney to fight the charges.
Can't Chuck go to jail for having stolen property?
Eventually. But his lawyer is going to play this out very slowly. In the big bad world of New York, a couple of stolen books is at the bottom of the court's to-do list.
That's not right.
She hadn't meant to raise her voice. The two scholars looked up from their work and she nodded serenely back at them, just as Claude entered, whistling the theme from the Pink Panther under his breath. The Lincoln Center Concert Hall where the New York Philharmonic performed wasn't Sadie's favorite venue in the city. Carnegie Hall was more beautiful and had better acoustics. But there was nothing that compared to the trio of buildings that made up the heart of the Lincoln Center campus. Alone, each one might have seemed stark, but arranged in a horseshoe shape around a burbling fountain, they became a kind of brutalist town center, reminding Sadie of the Italian village plazas that she and Philip had visited on their honeymoon. She perched on the lip of the fountain, watching the zigzag of audience members heading home after an evening of Wagner at the Metropolitan Opera House, or having caught the latest Wendy Wasserstein play. She'd just spent a blissful evening listening to an Elgar concerto at Avery Fisher Hall, and wasn't ready to leave. The blast of a trumpet caught her attention, then another joining the first in harmony. A set of drums kicked in, and finally an entire orchestra erupted in a swinging beat. Curious, she followed the sound to an open plaza just to the south of the opera house, where an outdoor stage had been set up. 100 people were gathered on the dance floor doing some kind of step that Sadie didn't recognize. A foxtrot? Not a tango, she knew that much. She watched in amazement at the mix of music and motion, hypnotized, the orchestra performance forgotten.
Sadie?
She turned to see Nick beside her, an amused smile on his face. Unsure, she gave a little wave just as he held out his hand to shake hers, which meant he only grasped the tips of her fingers, like one would greet the Queen of England. All the connection from their bond over Whitman and the stolen artifact seemed to have disappeared, replaced by discomfort.
"You a dancer?" he asked.
She shook her head. "No, I just got out of the Philharmonic. But isn't this incredible?"
"Sure is."
"What are you here to see?" He didn't seem like an opera lover type. Then again, he did enjoy poetry.
"I'm not here to see anything. I'm here to swing."
He gestured to the dance floor. "You?" She hadn't meant to sound so dubious.
He shrugged. "My wife made me take lessons for our wedding, and after we divorced, I thought I'd take it up again."
He had a hobby, just as her surviving spinsterhood book advised. The thought made her smile. The band finished, followed by applause from the crowd. A red-haired woman with matching lipstick and a short pink skirt took the microphone. She was all sharp angles from her nose to her knees, like a spindly coral reef. She called for everyone's attention in a raspy voice that was gritty and overly sweet at the same time, as if fueled by strawberry quick.
"It's salsa time. Beginners, welcome. Take the floor, my dancers."
Nick, to Sadie's horror, held out his hand.
"Shall we?"
While Lonnie had inherited the quick coordination of their father, something Valentina shared, Sadie had missed out on that particular family trait and was about as flexible as an 80-year-old man. She preferred walks in the park to anything active. Once, after a New Year's resolution, she'd joined a neighborhood gym and tried out a step class. Her foot had slipped after only 5 minutes and she landed with a thud on the floor. The instructor kept on shouting instructions as Sadie quickly collected her things and scrambled out the door, embarrassed and bruised.
"I don't dance."
"Neither do half the people here."
"Maybe we can just grab a drink instead?"
But it was too late. He gently pulled her to the middle of the dance floor. Sadie looked around, her heart pounding with fear, like she was about to jump out of an airplane. All the women were wearing dance shoes with a heel, while Sadie was in beat-up leather ballet flats, which, on her size 10 feet, resembled black flippers.
"It's easier to follow up near the front," he said.
She pretended she hadn't heard him. The music began, and she watched as the woman on stage, working with a partner, demonstrated the basic step and then encouraged them to give it a try. That part wasn't so difficult, moving on every count but 4 and 8, backward first and then forward. Nick held Sadie's hand in his lightly while the other rested on her shoulder blade. Not her waist, but up higher, and she liked that as he wouldn't be anywhere near the roll of flesh right above her waistband. Then the band began to play. To her surprise, she picked it up quickly, partly because the music made it so clear. Beat, 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 pause, beat, 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 pause. And also because Nick signaled with the lightest of touches which side she was to focus on. A squeeze of the fingers for the right, a push of his hand on her shoulder for the left. But when they moved on to turns and cross-body leads, she grew frustrated, confused about which way to go. And so for the rest of the song, they simply did the basic steps, as he moved her across the floor and then back the other way, gently, smoothly. It felt nice to be in someone's arms. Nick offered up an encouraging smile and laughed when they stepped on each other's toes. He was comfortable, in his element, which helped her to relax and enjoy the music and the sensation of gliding across the floor together. They continued on for 3 more songs, and as the final note sounded, she couldn't help but imagine what it would be like to kiss him, reaching over, touching his chin, and bringing her face to his. She wondered what his lips would feel like, what his tongue might feel like. The fact that they stood less than a foot apart without ever touching torsos made it even more agonizing. It was as if an invisible force ran between their chests, their stomachs, keeping them tantalizingly apart from each other. She hadn't felt this fiercely about a man in a while, hadn't known she still had it in her. After, he suggested they hit a nearby diner for coffee and pie. They slid into opposite sides of a booth, and she was glad they had a table between them, so she could pull herself back together. Her equilibrium had shifted out of whack as they danced. She felt like one of those levels used to hang pictures on a wall, the bubble drifting outside of its marks.
You like music, then?
He asked. My father was a musician, a session musician, played bass. So we always had music playing in the apartment. I love finding it wherever I can.
Lots of opportunities in this city.
Where you least expect it, like today.
It's neat that your dad was a musician. Is he still around?
She took a deep breath. My father passed away when I was 8. That was a tough year.
I'm sorry.
He rubbed his chin with his hands.
I know all about tough years. In the span of 12 months, Sue and I separated, then she got swindled, and then my spaniel died.
So many S's. He began to laugh, his eyes watering.
That's amazing.
What?
My dog. What do you think his name was?
Oh, no. She started to giggle as well.
Sebastian.
No!
Yes. Leave it to a librarian to point out the alliteration in my life's tragedies.
They talked of everything but the thefts, about his children and Sadie's niece. Nick asked where she liked to go to hear music, and she rattled off her favorites, relishing the shock on his face when she mentioned CBGB. Then the waitress came with the check, and there was the pulling out of wallets and Nick saying that he'd cover it and figuring out the tip. A giant wave of uncertainty washed over Sadie. What next? What if she'd said too much and made a fool of herself? She sat, frozen, unsure. She looked out the window, down at the table anywhere but at Nick's face. She had no confidence anymore and wasn't sure what to do or say. Outside on the street, they parted with a hug like two friends. Perhaps she was overthinking all this, and they were just colleagues. Or maybe he still considered her a suspect. It was all too draining. Which was why, the next day, she found herself in the stacks, waiting until there were no pages around to reread some of the spinster book, fortify herself with its timelessness.
Sadie?
Nick's voice rang out. She slid the book into her tote bag and stepped outside the cage, locking the door behind her. Yes. What are you doing down here?
Claude said you were here. I came to find you.
He shifted from one foot to the other.
Did you just put a book in your bag?
A book? The rules for anyone working in the stacks were clear. No placing books from the stacks into outside containers or bags. They were supposed to stay in plain sight at all times.
What's inside your tote bag?
She took a deep breath. This was awful. She hadn't meant to take the book, just gotten distracted when she'd heard his voice and tucked it away, out of sight. She pulled it out and handed it to him, looking off to the side as she did. He read the title out loud.
Surviving Spinsterhood, The Joys of Living Alone.
Oh. She squirmed as the words hung in the air. It might as well have been a pair of her underwear out there for everyone to see, all because she was stupid enough to think that an old book could fix what was wrong with her life. I accidentally put it inside my bag. So silly. I'll put it back. She grabbed the book from him and turned back to the cage, fumbling with the lock. Maybe he had been watching her, following her. Maybe this whole charade was just a way to catch her in the act. And she'd fallen right into it.
Chapter 15. New York City, 1914. Laura lifted her head up to the late March sun as she walked through Bryant Park on the way home from class, taking in the tantalizing hint of spring through the bare branches of the trees. 2 more months and she'd be done. The time had gone by so quickly. Laura! She turned to see Amelia seated on one of the benches, a book in her lap. Today, her usual uniform had been replaced with a blue plaid tunic and a brown velvet skirt that fell softly over her long legs. Amelia rose and greeted her with a light kiss on the cheek. The warmth of her lips on Laura's cheek lingered after she pulled away, smiling. Laura instinctively looked up at the imposing facade of the library, as if Jack might be in one of the windows looking down.
What are you doing here?
Together, they walked along the promenade toward Fifth Avenue. I haven't seen you in a while. I'm feeling quite bereft, not having my cub reporter by my side. Ever since the morning after the protest, Laura had meant to stop by Amelia's. She'd been downtown several times to finish up details on her thesis, but hadn't been able to. She didn't want to see Jessie lounging in the parlor, or hear her banging around in the kitchen as she and Amelia tried to talk. So instead, she'd avoided the street altogether. Besides, there was so much to do.
It's been busy at school. But really, what brings you to the library?
I was in the neighborhood and figured I'd linger in case you came by. And you did. Amelia had come for her. Laura didn't know how to answer.
What are you reading?
Amelia held up her book. The Awakening, one of my favorites.
You were reading that book the first time I ever saw you, at Vassar.
Laura blushed at having shared such a vivid detail. Always good to return to the favorites, I say.
Amelia paused.
Everyone at the club has been asking about you. It's been 3 weeks.
She'd kept count.
Laura's stomach flipped. Did you hear about what happened to Frank Tannenbaum? According to the papers, Mr. Tannenbaum had been one of 190 men arrested the night of the protest.
I did. It's terrible.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to speak with you. Laura had hoped Amelia had come by because she missed her. Obviously not. The patrons of Mabel Dodge's salon arranged a fund to bail the protesters out, but we just learned today that Frank's sentence is a year.
A year? That's ridiculous.
They turned right just before Fifth Avenue, heading toward the front entrance. I know. We're asking for everyone's help to get the word out about this injustice, about how the protest was squashed. So that was why she'd come. I'm not a real reporter. It's all just for practice. The blotto, remember? You'll be one soon enough, and maybe there's something you can do now.
Like what?
I don't know. Talk to your professors, something like that. Maybe they have colleagues at the papers who can take up the cause.
Reporters aren't supposed to take up causes. Besides, I can barely catch my breath these days. I'm hanging on by a thread.
Laura knew she was being unnecessarily obstinate. She was a terrible person, awful. Amelia came to a stop beside one of the lions and looked at her curiously. Are you sure there's nothing wrong? Between us? Was it something I did or said?
No, of course not.
Laura shouldn't behave this way with her friend, pushing her away. She tried to explain.
I'll pass on the information about Frank to the other students and mention it to my professor. I'm sure someone will jump at the chance to cover it.
I appreciate it. She couldn't help herself.
How's Jessie?
We broke up. Laura tried to rearrange her features into that of a caring friend, one for whom the news was just that, news, not a soaring relief, a gift.
You did? When?
The day after the protest. I didn't want to be with her anymore, and I'd felt that way for a while, just hadn't reckoned with it until then. She was sad, but understood. She was so much younger, and it began to fray my nerves. The kiss Laura had witnessed was one of parting, not passion. But her joy quickly curdled. How easy it was for Amelia to discard a lover who no longer pleased. A bitter envy welled up inside Laura, and she hated herself for it. She wanted to be free to love like that, even just for a day.
On to the next girlfriend, then?
Amelia studied her. Maybe. Maybe not. To be honest,
I find your question rather patronizing. Laura had meant it to be flippant, but instead she came off churlish and stern, just like her father. Patronizing, what a horrible word. She was too close to her subjects for this thesis, too caught up in the Heterodoxy Club's mystique and revolutionary ideas, the members' pleas for equality. She'd lost her impartiality, a dangerous thing for a reporter. Even worse, she'd fallen in love with her source. She imagined leaning in and kissing Amelia right here on the steps of the library, in front of the whole world. She looked around, as if waking from a trance, horrified at the thought. No, this wasn't love. It was a crush. Amelia was everything Laura wished to be, brash, outspoken, taking what she wanted. And so Laura had somehow projected her own desires on the embodiment of them, Dr. Amelia Potter, the new woman of Bohemia. She'd taken it too far, and regretted getting so caught up. Amelia's world was so different from her own, an exotic country with its own rules and laws. Laura could never fit in. For all of her mother's urging to follow her passions, this was not what she'd meant, not in the least. I'm sorry, you're right, Amelia. I guess I just worry for you, that's all. I'm the last person you need to worry about, my dear. She leaned against the lion's pedestal. Which one is this? I'm sorry? Which lion, Lennox or Aster? Amelia looked up at the sculptured feline. Aster. The one to the south is Lennox. I love that you know that. Amelia flashed a warm smile, and Laura couldn't help but return it. Then they both laughed, the sound breaking through the awkwardness. They were dear friends after all. Will we see you at the meeting on Saturday? She could use a little more color for her thesis, which was due in 2 weeks. Now that she'd thought through her complicated feelings and come out the other side, she felt more in balance, more in control. Amelia was her friend, that was all, and that was enough. Of course. I'll see you there. Thank you for coming uptown. Inside the library, Laura encountered Jack on the narrow stairway that led to their apartment. There you are! He pulled her upstairs to the landing and lifted her into the air. Jack, what on earth is going on?
I came up to tell you some good news.
They've caught the thief?
Her guess was off, judging from the dismayed look on his face. She couldn't seem to read him anymore, to say the right thing.
No, I'm afraid not. In fact, another 2 books were picked off this week.
That's terrible. Again, why hadn't he told her? It was as if he'd held back the information on purpose.
Certainly. However, since I don't have access to the collection anymore, it means I am no longer a suspect. This has to do with my own book. An agent has asked to read it.
You finished it?
Yes, I finished it. Your patience with me has been wonderful, Laura. I don't tell you that enough, and I'm sorry. After I finished it, I felt oddly forlorn, which is why I didn't mention it. I haven't been a good father, a good husband, as this manuscript has had me by the horns.
You have seemed removed lately, that's true. But so have I. We've both been through a tough year.
Saying it out loud was such a relief, she threw her arms around his neck.
I'm so proud of you. You finished the book. That's an incredible accomplishment.
They stood there, rocking each other gently, the motion refilling the reserves of love Laura felt for her husband.
Tell me all about the agent.
I saw him in the main reading room when we were conducting an inspection of the pneumatic tubes. He knew my friend Billy from back in the day and came up to say hello. I wasn't sure if it was too forward of me, but I knew this might be my only chance, my only connection. So I gave him a pitch, told him all about it. He said he'd like to read it, and I'm dropping it off at his office tomorrow in person.
That's wonderful.
Follow me.
He led her to his study, where a thick ream of papers sat in the very center of his desk, tied with string.
There she is. Would you like to read it before I send it out?
I'd love to. She checked the clock. But let me first get dinner started, so the children aren't hungry.
I'll do that. You sit by the fire and have a read, and I'll put together something for us.
You?
The thought made her giggle. You'd be surprised at my culinary skill. Back when I was an eligible young bachelor, I was quite handy.
She did as she was told, and a half hour later was called into the kitchen for scrambled eggs on toast. What on earth? She said, laughing.
Dad says today's an upside-down day, announced Pearl, clutching her fingers together with excitement. Breakfast is for dinner.
Harry brought the plates to the table, arranging them carefully in between the forks and knives. The last one he dropped, and it clattered to the floor, eggs scattering across the tiles.
I'm sorry.
Tears welled up in his eyes.
But that's perfect, said Jack. It's upside down day, so dinner's on the floor, not the table.
Really?
Harry looked over at Laura for confirmation. Exactly right, she said.
I know, said Pearl. We should eat sitting on the floor. Don't worry, Harry. I'll get you a new plate.
They left the mess and settled on the rug in the living room, like a group of picnickers in Central Park. Pearl spoke of her favorite teacher, going on and on at length, until finally Laura interrupted and asked Harry about his.
You're my favorite teacher, he answered.
Jack reached over and put his large hand over the boy's bony shoulder.
Good answer, my child. Mine too.
That evening, Laura dove into Jack's manuscript, the only sound the low murmur of Jack reading aloud to the children from the other room. The next day, he woke her from the easy chair where she'd fallen asleep, the last few pages on her lap.
How was it?
She yawned and smiled up at him. Losing a night of sleep had been well worth it.
Wonderful. Brilliant.
You're not saying that because you're married to me, are you?
It's one of the best books I've read in ages.
She wasn't lying. He'd captured the internal and external journey of a young man coming to New York at the turn of the century with an acuity that took her breath away.
It's splendid, and I couldn't be prouder of you.
At the Saturday meeting of the Heterodoxy Club, Laura was greeted like a returning hero, or, more aptly, heroine, for having braved the protest with Amelia, for being part of the revolution. She tried to downplay her role in the demonstration, since she was truly there just as an observer, but that didn't matter. Jessie approached Amelia, the two of them sharing a friendly chat before the opening remarks, but it didn't bother Laura at all. What she'd experienced earlier in the month was simply leftover anxiety from being so close to violence, most likely. Needing a comrade to deal with the aftershocks, and that comrade naturally being Amelia, who took charge and offered safety. They were just friends, and that was perfectly fine, perfectly normal. She and Jack had weathered the storms of the past few months and come out the other end, now that he'd completed his book. A hat was passed around for a collection for Frank Tannenbaum's defense, and she handed over the money she'd put aside for her lunch. In the near future, she'd have a steady stream of income of her own. That day couldn't come soon enough. Her master's thesis was almost finished, but she'd been worrying about how to wrap it all up. Inspiration, once again, came from the day's speaker, a woman named Inez Haynes Gilmore, who read from a series of articles she'd published in Harper's Bazaar, titled Confessions of an Alien.
It seems to me, began Inez, I hang in a void midway between two spheres, the man's sphere and the woman's sphere. The duties and pleasure of the average woman bore and irritate. The duties and pleasures of the average man, interest and allure. I soon found that it was a feeling which I shared with the majority of my kind. I have never met a man who at any time wanted to be a woman. I have met few women who have not at some time or other wanted to be men. At this, the members in the audience broke out in applause. For the first time, Laura wondered if she wouldn't be happier as a journalist who went beyond mere reporting and actually stated an opinion, like Inez. Inez's words struck a chord in every woman present, more than if she'd simply reported on the increase in the number of women working outside the home, reflecting the facts back to the public in the hopes that they understood the implications. What if she wrote specifically to further a cause, in order to change minds? She wasn't ready for that, not yet. For now, she had to stick to the facts if she wanted to graduate. Professor Wakeman would have a fit otherwise. Luckily, when she'd shown the rough draft of her master's thesis to him, he'd told her it was impressive.
"But it's a mess," he'd added. "Tighten it up and get the sections to flow together better. Your transitions need work. However, I could see a book in this."
A book? She'd almost fainted. Of course it couldn't be a book, as the club had its rules. But maybe after Amelia saw the finished thesis, she'd be just as impressed as Professor Wakeman and convince the others to give their consent. To think that both she and Jack could have books of their own. In fact, once they were situated in their new careers, he could quit his job at the library, and maybe they'd find a pretty apartment in the village. Professor Wakeman had handed the pages back to her.
"It's better than the other women's work I've seen so far, I'll give you that. Tighten it up and turn it in. I want it perfect."
She knew his idea of perfection was higher than any other advisor's. No spelling errors, no dangling prepositions. Not only did the story have to be solid, but the presentation did too. Sunday evening, she retreated to Jack's desk in the study to finish up the conclusion of her thesis. Now that he'd finished his book, she didn't feel so obtrusive when she placed his many to-do lists in a neat pile in one corner. The best way to approach a challenge is methodically, he'd always say, before spreading out her own notes across the leather blotter. He walked in and gave her a kiss on the head. "How's it going?" "I have a new appreciation for what you've been through the past several years. How do I distill everything I've learned into a final section that's powerful, but not repetitive?"
"Remember what made you want to write this in the first place? Where that first spark of an idea came from? You can do it. I know you can."
After he left, she remained in place, staring out the window. She'd wanted to demonstrate what women were thinking, what the new woman was thinking specifically. The women she respected most were those who followed their passion and weren't afraid to speak the truth out loud, like Amelia. Like her mother, although it was a more muted passion, she being of an older generation. If her mother had been born later, Laura had no doubt she'd be out there marching, instead of dependent on her husband for every little thing. Laura picked up her pen and began scribbling over the typewritten words on the final pages of the latest draft, editing each paragraph one by one. She'd end this on a sharp note, she decided. She'd take a position, make a stand, and show how much this story meant to her, instead of hiding behind dry facts and quotes. It was a risk, she knew, but wasn't that what Amelia had done when she'd performed health inspections, when every other doctor faked the reports? When Frank Tannenbaum led hundreds in protest? By comparison, this act of rebellion was a minor one. Professor Wakeman had believed she might eventually write a book. Why not show him how much she could do with words? Thank goodness she'd gone back to the club to get this last dose of inspiration before the final push. After she finished editing, She put a fresh piece of paper into the typewriter and retyped the last few pages, incorporating the new sections. After a thorough proofread, she placed the new pages at the bottom of the stack and sat back smiling. Her thesis was complete. 3 weeks later, she sat next to Gretchen outside Professor Wakeman's office on the 7th floor of the journalism school, waiting their turns for his critique. After this hurdle came final exams, and then graduation, which was to be held on the lawn in front of the university's library. She imagined her father's face in the crowd, finally proud. Her mother, crying and flapping her arms about like a pigeon.
"Last year, only a third of the class graduated," said Gretchen. "That's only 9 of us."
"I know. But we've both turned in consistently good work." As the semester had progressed, Laura and Gretchen had relied on each other, figuring out ways to circumvent the professor's sexism and comparison.